This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Although science fiction is the only genre in which wildly different possibilities for the future can be contemplated, one thing is almost always the same in science fiction. Whether humanity is uploaded into machines, imprisoned in Martian slime pits, merged in hybrid superorganisms, or interbreeding with giant insectoids, everybody is always straight. The glaring nature of this bias about the future, did they invent a straight pill? Did all the queer embryos get jettisoned? Is brought home when one reads fiction that takes queer desire for granted. Nicola Griffith is such an author. Her first novel, the paperback Ammonite, won the James Tiptree Award and Lambda Literary Awards. Her Slow River was winner of the 1997 Nebula Award for Best Novel and 1996 Lambda Award. Her Yaguara won the 1996 Nebula for Best Novella. Now she has embarked on a series of thrillers with heroine Aud Tarvinen, who is, in the words of one reviewer, a physically perfect security consultant, beautiful martial arts expert, and cobalt-hard sensualist, whom the New York Daily News has called the love child of Smilla and Nikita. Aud, like the protagonists of all Nicola's work, is a lesbian, as is the author. Welcome, Nicola Griffith.
Hello.
Now, you are British. Why did you first come to the States?
Actually, it was 1988. Yes, I came here and I was here for 7 weeks. I spent a week in New York and then I flew off to MSU where I went to the Clarion workshop. And there I met Kelly, mm-hmm. my partner, the woman I live with now. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I couldn't stay here. I had to go back to England because I had a job and a mortgage and a life. I had another partner in England and I couldn't just drop everything and stay here. Plus, there was a little matter of immigration to deal with. So, yeah, I went back to England for about a year. And then I came back here for a visit to see Kelly and make sure everything was as I, in fact, remembered it. And then I went back to England, sold my house, left my job, packed everything into two suitcases, and moved.
So you migrated for love rather than opportunities for fame and fortune?
Definitely. Yeah. It was all about the fact that Kelly was here. We tried to figure out whether Kelly should come to England. And decided in the end that really that was pointless. There were several reasons for that. One was that immigration is just as hard getting into England as it is to get into this country. Two, I was ill and I wouldn't be able to work anyway, so it made sense for the partner who couldn't work for health reasons to also be the one who couldn't work immigration-wise and visa-wise. And three, this country just seemed a little bit more exciting than England.
Now, is that true in the literary sense as well? Have you found that the science fiction happening here is substantially different from that in Britain?
Yes and no. It's not so much the literary work itself, it's the attitude behind it. For example, in England, people would say to me, "Oh dear, and what do you do?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm unemployed." Or, "Well, you know, I've written some short stories." And they'd say, "I see. Well, very nice. Never mind. Pat, pat." Whereas in this country, the first time I opened my mouth and said, "I'm unemployed," when someone asked me what I wanted to do, Kelly jabbed me with her elbow and said, "You are not unemployed, you're a writer." I said, "Well, okay, but I don't have a job." She said, "No, writing is your job." And I said, "Okay." So then I started telling people, "Oh, I'm a writer." And instead of doing the English thing, which is, "Well, dear, you must do it under another name because I've never heard of you," it's, "Oh, where can I go get your stuff?" There's this willingness for one to be successful in this country. It's the whole American dream thing.
Mm-hmm. So you think the domination of the class system or the traditional professions in England is makes for a less open environment?
Yes. I think it also has a lot to do with the whole loss of empire thing, a certain cynicism.
Hmm. Now, your genre choices, you started in science fiction and you're also editing an anthology on gay, lesbian, it's called Bending the Landscape, mm-hmm. and it's anthologies of fantasy, science fiction, and horror that have gay, lesbian protagonists or themes.
Mm-hmm.
So you've worked a lot in the SF and its related genres, and you recently decided to move into mystery. What's driving your genre choices?
I could come up with rationalizations. But basically, it just seemed like the right thing to do. But anyway, let me come up with a rationalization. I first wrote science fiction because I was very, very angry. I had something to say about the roles of women and men in the world. And science fiction is really designed to look at groups of people, systems, theories of science and sociology and the way things slot together. And I was very angry. I had just read a bunch of feminist literature for the first time when I was, oh, I think I was probably about 21. And I was awake at 3 in the morning, and I just decided to write a short story called Women and Children First, all about this generation spaceship hurtling through the void and what happened when it hits an asteroid, and everyone has to go to the life pods, and the captain, you know, the sort of lantern George Stern guy, says, women and children first. And so the women and children say, oh, sure. And they get in the life pods, go to the planet, and lo and behold, found a sort of utopian world. Except I started thinking, well, it wouldn't be a utopia. There are lots of foul women, just as there are lots of foul men, you know, and nothing would be perfect. And the story grew and grew and grew and became a novel. And all of a sudden I found that, wow, I was writing science fiction. And so I wrote another novel. And I put both of those in a drawer, and then I wrote another novel, and that one sold.
Mm-hmm. So Yaguara was your second novel?
Yaguara isn't a novel, it's a novella,
mm-hmm.
and it's actually fantasy.
Oh.
Yeah, well, it has some sort of vague, fast-talking science patter over the outside, but essentially it's a fantasy.
Mm-hmm. So Slow River was the first to sell?
No, Ammonite.
Ammonite was the first to sell.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A lot of the stuff in Ammonite actually came from the first thoughts I had that horrible night
mm-hmm.
at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was about 21 or 22.
Mm.
But yeah, so now I'm doing what my publisher is calling suspense fiction. I don't call it anything because I really haven't a clue what it is. Because as I get older, I'm moving away from the whole idea of people being dictated to by systems, and I'm seeing people more and more as individuals. And I wanted to write a book or a series of books about a character and her growth and her change.
Mm-hmm. So there will be growth and change with Aud Torvinen, because, is that how you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Aud Torvinen.
Aud Torvinen, because your reviewers have pointed out that she's a pretty superheroine kind of person already.
Well, that's the actual point. I mean, she's essentially an unreliable narrator. On first appearance, she strikes one as completely flawless and sealed and utterly competent. And in many ways, she is very competent, but she is sealed off from the world because inside there's a lot of damage. And the whole thrust of The Blue Place, the first in the series, is about her allowing herself to see the fact that she's damaged and beginning to thaw, if you like, for her frozen center to begin to thaw. And it's the first book in the story of her change and growth.
Oh. So more romance, more opening up in terms of personality with other people?
Well, the second book, there's no romance at all. I'm in the middle of rewriting that one, actually. She's basically insane and halfway up a mountain. Mm-hmm. There's no romance at all. It's all quite grim, except I hate books that are entirely grim. I love books with hope, and I love books with actual plots where stuff happens, which is why I've worked in the genres, why I wrote science fiction to begin with, and am now working in the suspense field, because it seems to me that mainstream fiction has this horrible tendency to just stare endlessly at its own navel. It likes to experiment with form, but not with story and character.
Now, you've been a martial arts instructor back in Britain, I take it, and have been a long time involved with the martial arts, and your current heroine is a martial arts person. Can you say a little bit about, what I found really fascinating reading about the things that you've had to say about this already is that your interest in the martial arts and in the body has created a certain fascination with the visceral details that you like to depict in your fiction. Is there a connection there?
Definitely. I have never been a martial arts instructor. I used to teach women's self-defense, and the two actually are quite different. Self-defense obviously utilizes lots of blocks, kicks, punches, wrist locks, and so on that several martial arts do, but it's also a psychological process. It's all about understanding when you're in danger and being assertive and so on and so forth. There's lots of practical advice. You know, I tell people how to turn various household items into weapons and so on, but you don't really learn that stuff in martial arts. And I did that for 5 or 6 years in the UK. I really enjoyed it, and I'm very sorry that I'm physically no longer able to do it because I have MS.
Mm-hmm. So,
but the MS plus the physical work I've done has really led me into the kind of writing I do now, because it's led to this focus on detail, whether that's visceral, physical, internal detail, or very close attention to the physical world out there detail. For example, when I've been very ill, I haven't been able to get up and move around, so I just stare out of the window, and I watch how things change. I really pay attention to tiny little details, and that's really informed my fiction the last few years.
Now, the MS is something that you mentioned. You actually ran across my website. I had had you as on my wish list of people that I wanted to interview.
Right.
And you mentioned an interest in some of the biotech stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You've in your science fiction, you've addressed several biotechnology themes, the parthenogenesis and ecology issues very dramatically, and slow river.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an ongoing interest in biotech? Is that something that might inform your thrillers as well?
Definitely. I'm very interested in it. I am informed only to a fairly rudimentary level. I mean, I studied biology at school, and I started a microbiology degree in England and left after about 10 weeks. But I occasionally pick up a copy of Nature, or I read Science News, or I look on the web every now and again, and when something catches my eye, I'll read it. But right now, my interest in biotech is more to do selfishly with my own health. I read a press release in September from Johns Hopkins about a process. I'm sure you've heard of autologous stem cell transplants.
Yes.
Well, now they've taken that one step further, which is they basically kill off your immune system, but then they don't give you a stem cell transplant. They just sit back and watch and expect your stem cells to survive the killing of the rest of your immune system, and then they wait and see what happens. And it seems to be working fabulously for the few people they have tried it on so far. It's basically an immune system reboot.
So that seems to have some efficacy with MS?
It's been very useful with people with other autoimmune disorders. They haven't actually tried it on people with MS yet.
Mm-hmm.
I have been pestering everybody in the known world about this, sending emails and phoning them up. And basically the FDA has now stepped in and prohibited essentially off-label use of this technique, so nobody will do it for me because I am, quote, too highly functioning, unquote.
Mm.
But I'm hoping that within 2 or 3 years there'll be enough data about this stuff for me to persuade somebody to help me out.
Well, that's very interesting, because my own interests in biotechnology also have a lot to do with my own expectation of personal benefit, and I think we educated consumers of healthcare driving a lot of reform. You know, in the disability rights movement, it's very interesting that Christopher Reeves has become a real annoyance to some of the more traditional disability rights folks, because he's been pushing for spinal remediation, spinal repair technologies that are going to come online pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But the traditional folks are all about support for employment, Disability Rights Act, and so forth, things like that, rather than the repairs and the cures.
Yeah, I mean, get to the root of the problem. All this, you know, palliative nonsense is just a waste of time. Well, it's not a waste of time. It's very useful. It's very important. But
right,
that's not where my interest lies. I mean, I could shout till I'm blue in the face about making sure there's a ramp at the library for a wheelchair, but I frankly would rather have the procedure that made it so that I don't have to use a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use a wheelchair yet, but frankly, it's a question of time. I mean, I've gone from being able to do a fair amount of exercise and doing some martial arts every now and again to having a hard time walking, and now I'm using a cane.
Mm-hmm.
And it infuriates me, frankly, because there is this procedure out there. Yes, it's rather radical. It can be dangerous, but I'm a grown-up. I've read the research. it looks good, I'm willing to take the chance. It's just that the FDA says, mm-mm, can't allow you to do that.
I imagine that in the women's community out there in Seattle that there's a similar close relationship with the disability rights movement. And have you been involved at all with that?
Actually, no. The startling thing about since Kelly and I came to live in Seattle, which was about 4 years ago now, I have not been involved in any kind of community here, not the lesbian community or the science fiction community or the women's community or the disability community. We've just found a few friends and basically had our heads down working and having a life. It's been quite interesting. I said to Kelly the other day, I said, do you realize we don't have any lesbian friends? And she looked and she said, you're right. And I said, well, do you miss it? She said, no, I like the friends we've got now. And I said, me too. But it was very weird. I've spent my whole life being in tightly knit communities, and all of a sudden, that's no longer true.
It's kind of the mainstreaming of queer culture in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of your protagonists, all of your protagonists, have been lesbians up to this point, and you had in your first novel an entirely female world,
mm-hmm.
Although some of the reviewers pointed out, and I was very struck when I read Slow River, that with Slow River, it began to seem that sexuality was just taken for granted, that there wasn't a very big deal being made of the fact that that people had one sexual preference or another, although male heterosexuality was so absent from the picture that it was you know, there wasn't anybody was mad about it or trying to avoid it. It just wasn't there. But were you inspired by previous lesbian, all-female writers like Joanna Russ's Female Man and The Wonderground are two 70s examples of all-female worlds?
Yes and no. I think what I have written could not have been done without them breaking some barriers and chopping out some paths from the jungle. But when I first read Sally Miller Gearhart's The Wonderground, and I read it in, oh my God, about 1980, I think, I was gobsmacked by it. I thought, oh, this is really different. This is amazing. And I read through it, and I thought, this is the most amazing book. And then I started to think about it, and I thought, wow, what a load of cobblers. I mean, it was, I just got very annoyed with it, this whole essentialist thing about all women are lovely and all men are scum, except the gay boys, of course, who are sort of given trusty status. I mean, it was infuriating. And so part of Ammonite was a reaction to that. Plus, reading Joanna Russ's work, I think she influenced me more than I knew. I mean, the whole thing about viruses and so on. I think unconsciously I took that page from her book. My brain is dying.
I don't want to tax you too much, but another person who's written about an all one gender world is Lois Bujold. I'm a big fan of her Miles Verkosigan character and some of the things that she's done. Also, having introduced lesbi-gay themes, have you taken a look at Lois Bujold at all?
I have read one of her books, and it had Miles in it, but I couldn't tell you the title of it.
Uh-huh.
But I really quite enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that she's not taken more seriously in the academic what academic community there is with regard to science fiction, because I think she's rather good and I think she raises interesting issues. But she certainly hasn't been an influence on me. She's developed
mm-hmm.
really on a parallel track.
Right. Well, she's got kind of a stealth influence because she's got a readership out there. But, you know, if you look at Ethan of Athos, which is her all-male gay world, basically, it's really quite striking that it's that kind of fiction's out there. And she's not pegged as a gay writer.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she's had fiction that's been about gay and lesbian.
Oh, I know. It makes me, mostly it makes me laugh. Every now and again it makes me quite irritable. This whole, oh, that Nicola Griffiths, she's a lesbian science fiction writer. Well, the fact is that I am a dyke and I do sometimes write science fiction. But it's, well, okay, take Jane Austen. Jane Austen was a straight girl. She wrote endlessly about other straight girls and straight boys. In fact, you could argue that her work was the quintessential straight fiction, because it's about that wonderful bastion of straight privilege, marriage, a lot of the time. But do people call her, you know, a straight white girl writer? No, they just say Jane Austen, the novelist. And it seems that the further the writer is from society's norm, which right now, of course, is male and white and middle class, the more likely that your lifestyle is going to be attached to your label as an artist.
It's particularly striking in SF because you expect people in the SF community to have a kind of to not be bound in the same way by the sets of conventions. I mean, if they're willing to imagine relationships between humans and aliens, you know, which is a fairly commonplace in a lot of fiction, or if you look at Star Trek, where humans and aliens have been getting it on since the 60s, but you have almost no gay and lesbian characters in all of the Star Trek genre or all of the Star Wars or any of the other popular science fiction genres.
I know. I mean, there's all that fuss in Star Trek about, are there going to be any lesbian and gay characters on screen? And then they had that kiss between Dax and the other Trill person, which I thought was, you know, not bad, but then that was it. That's all we have seen. And I don't understand why not. I think it's just it's a bit too close to home for some people. And, of course, it's all tied in with advertising and sponsorship. People don't want to offend the makers of toothpaste or whoever is pouring dollars into the syndication stuff.
You've been a big hit with the Lambda Literary Awards, folks. Can you tell us a little bit about where the gay and lesbian science fiction community is at and where the Lambda Awards come from?
The Lambda Literary Awards is sponsored by the Lambda Literary Foundation, which is a non-profit foundation. And every year in various genres, there's lesbian fiction, gay fiction, there's autobiography, there's science fiction and fantasy, there's anthology, and so on. There's probably about 10 categories. And the initial process is voted on by the readership, and then a panel of judges is put in place, and they select the finalists and then the winner. And for whatever reason, they have showered me with awards, and I have really enjoyed it. It's quite interesting because they seem to ignore a lot of what I think of as mainstream science fiction with dykes and gay boys in it in favor of the small press stuff, which is more about being a lesbian than about any science fiction.
Hmm. Okay, well, I really want to say that I appreciate your coming on the air, and I hope that you can recoup some energy today to write. You have said in your interviews that MS has slowed down your writing process. Have you made adaptations to that? Are you finding different ways of writing, being creative around the MS?
I'm finding that I have to basically not fight the MS. If I wake up and my brain is feeling very tired and slippery, there's absolutely no point forcing myself to sit in front of the computer because the words will not make sense no matter how hard I try. So on those days, I just make myself a nice cup of tea, get out a box of chocolates, you know, get out an old favorite like Lord of the Rings or something and just settle down and try not to feel guilty for not working.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.